From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Quibus, sitting in for John Horn. We'll hear from John in just a minute. He just arrived at the Sundance Film Festival for the annual movie marathon in the mountains. Also on today's show, Daniel Levy talks about co-creating and starring with his real-life dad, Eugene Levy, on a hit sitcom.
I mean, certainly there are buttons I know that I can write into the show that I can push for him, which is fun. I know sort of more intimately what gets his goat.
And a new work by choreographer Sebastian Hernandez takes its inspiration from horticulture. All that coming up on The Frame.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Quibus, sitting in today for John Horn, who just arrived in Park City, Utah for the Sundance Film Festival. There's going to be more than 100 new feature films screening there over the next several days. Just some of the highlights include the Netflix-produced Velvet Buzzsaw, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Chinese-American director Lulu Wang's The Farewell, starring Awkwafina, and a slew of documentaries, including one that's got festival officials a little antsy over possible protests. John Horn has just arrived at Sundance, and he joins me now to give us a preview of the festival. John, with so many film screenings to check out, how do you prioritize what you're going to see?
I actually clone myself, so it is possible to see 18 movies a day. You just have to choose. I mean, I think you look for interesting people, interesting themes, filmmakers whose work you might know. Tonight, for example, I think it's pretty easy to figure out what we're going to see. There's a movie called After the Wedding. It premieres tonight. It's adapted from a 2006 movie written and directed by Suzanne Bier, who just made Bird Box for Netflix. It stars Julianne Moore and Michelle Williams. And then kind of on the other end of the spectrum is a movie playing in the narrative competition category. It's called Native Son. It's based on the Richard Wright novel, and it's adapted by playwright Susan Laurie Parks, and it's directed by a visual artist named Rashid Johnson, and it's his first feature. So very different films. One has a lot of money, high pedigree. The other one's a newcomer, and both are kind of what Sundance is about.
And what are some of the other films that audiences seem most excited about seeing this year?
Chiwetel Ejiofor, who starred in 12 Years a Slave, has directed his first feature. It's a true story about a young man who figures out how to create wind energy in Malawi. It's called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. There's a midnight film that also stars a veteran of 12 Years a Slave, Lupita Nyong'o. It's called Little Monsters. It's a scary movie. Adam Driver, who a lot of people know from Star Wars, has made a movie called The Report. It's directed by Scott Burns and produced by Steven Soderbergh. It's about the CIA's detention and interrogation program. Annette Bening, John Hamm, Michael C. Hall are also in it. So again, incredibly diverse films, all have something to recommend them. But again, you could choose a couple dozen other movies to check out.
Harvey Weinstein is the subject of a new documentary. It's called Untouchable, and it's screening it there at Sundance. What do you know about it?
Well, Untouchable is a documentary that involves interviews with many of the women who claim that they were sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. And I think it's really important that it's premiering in Park City, Utah, because there are allegations that Harvey Weinstein assaulted women during the festival in years past. So in many ways, and the festival has been very aggressive about dealing with creating a safe place for everybody who attends in terms of making sure that nobody's harassed or assaulted. But the fact that this movie is playing at Sundance, where for many years, Harvey Weinstein was the king of Sundance, the king of Park City, I think it's incredibly important to not only tell the stories of the survivors of his alleged attacks, but also to bring Park City back to what it was without Harvey Weinstein.
Well, Sundance is hugely important as a platform for documentary filmmakers in general. What's caught your eye on the schedule?
Well, four of the five films that are nominated for the Oscar documentary feature premiered here a year ago. In terms of what I'm excited about, Alex Gibney, who is an Oscar-winning filmmaker, has a new film about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos and that whole blood scam. There's a Danish documentary about the plane crash that killed former UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. It's called Cold Case Hammarskjöld. It's supposed to be amazing. And then there's a new documentary series that's premiering tomorrow morning about Michael Jackson called Finding Neverland that's right. already been the subject of a lot of attention and criticism. And finally, a documentary called Hail Satan, which is about Satanists, but it's really about religious tolerance and religious plurality in the United States.
The Jackson documentary is based in part on allegations brought against him by two young men who claim Jackson abused them at the ages of 7 and 10. So I hear there's apparently some security concerns over the Friday and Saturday screenings. What are festival officials worried about?
Well, they're worried about threats that have been made to the festival, and they are going to be very careful about security at the festival. And you never really see much security here. I mean, there might be people who are making sure that audience members aren't secretly taping a film, but they're going to have bomb-sniffing dogs. They're going to have undercover officers with weapons. They're going to have a lot of visible and, I suspect, hidden security. We should note that the Jackson estate says that the documentary is, quote, just another rehash of dated and discredited allegations. But there are a lot of people who support Michael Jackson and have really attacked the festival for showing this film. And it's going to screen just around the corner from our condo. I suspect we'll be hearing a lot more tomorrow morning about the protests involving that film.
Yeah, if you don't witness them yourself firsthand. I wanted to ask, too, how is Sundance doing this year when it comes to representation of films made by LGBTQ filmmakers, women, and people of color?
They are doing much better than other festivals. If you look at last year's Telluride Film Festival, for example, there were only two narrative features that were premiering there that were made by female directors. And if you look at Sundance, of the 61 directors who are credited on 56 films, because some have co-credits, 42% are women, 39% are people of color, and 23% are people who identify as LGBTQ. Sundance has been very active outside of the festival in promoting filmmakers who come from underrepresented groups. It's always been something that's been important to them, but in the last couple of years, they've really stepped it up.
That's Frame host John Horn talking to us from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. John, thanks a lot, and bundle up.
We will. It's only 32 degrees, but I think it's going to get colder soon.
All right. Take care, John.
Okay, thanks.
John Horn will host The Frame from the Sundance Film Festival starting tomorrow. And coming up, actor-writer Daniel Levy on the breakout success of his sitcom, co-created with his dad, Eugene Levy. Now, before we bring you the next segment, here's a friendly warning about some language you're about to hear. There's a really funny sitcom on the Pop Cable Network that's named after the tiny town where it's set, Schitt's Creek. And that's spelled S-C-H-I-T-T-S. It's also where the show's main characters, the once very wealthy Rose family, find themselves literally and metaphorically after losing everything. The series, now in its fifth season, depicts the Roses as they rebuild their lives and their relationship as a family. It was co-created by Daniel Levy and his father, the veteran comedic actor Eugene Levy. They also portray father and son in the show. And in this scene, the elder Levy, as patriarch Johnny Rose, schools his adult son, David, on something he never had to worry about. Until now.
Ah, David Rose. You're applying for the bag boy position.
Yeah.
Tell me, David, why do you want this job?
I don't want this job.
Well, thank you very much, and don't expect a phone call.
Okay.
All right, do it right, or let's not do it. I'm going to start again.
Okay.
Tell me, David, why do you want this job?
I ran out of eye cream.
Okay, you're not going to get this job. You're not going to get this job.
Daniel Levy told me he sometimes draws on his real-life relationship with his dad to help shape the script and the on-screen gags.
I mean, certainly there are buttons I know that I can write into the show that I can push for him, which is fun. I know sort of more intimately what gets his goat. In our first season, for example, I wrote an episode where Johnny, which is the character my dad plays on the show, wakes up to a leak in the ceiling and dirty water had been dripping on his head all night long. My dad is someone who takes great care an attention to his hair. He does not like people touching it. Knowing that, writing an episode where he has to wake up with just a wet, sopping wet head of hair, to me was very funny, and unfortunately turned into a very funny scene. So, yeah, of course, I think having that kind of father-son relationship, we can access things that you wouldn't normally be able to access, you know, if we didn't have that, especially the sort of bickering back and forth and all that fun stuff.
You and your younger sister, Sarah, who in the show has a recurring role as Twyla, the sweet but dim-witted waitress at the local diner, you yes. were actually raised in your native Canada, even though your dad, Eugene Levy, was working a lot in Hollywood. What led to your parents' decision to bring you up away from that Hollywood life?
Yeah, he wanted us to have a very sort of, for lack of a better word, normal upbringing. And I know that it must have been a great sacrifice for him. Not being in Los Angeles as an actor is not the wisest choice, if you were to ask probably an agent. But I think it's a testament to my dad's values and really how he's managed to navigate a career in this industry that is entirely on his terms. And that's a pretty admirable thing.
Mm. Your character in the show, David, is pansexual. And what I really like is that his sexuality is never a point of conflict in the show. He's not struggling with it, nor is he ever attacked for it. What is in conflict, though, is how he navigates a very kind of tumultuous love life and his struggles with intimacy. So how did you decide to play him this way?
I think it was about wanting to tell a story that had a happy ending. I think so many queer relationships are met with conflict or tragedy. And it's funny because even in the first couple seasons of my relationship now with my boyfriend on the show, we were hearing so many people over Twitter and social media saying, when's it all going to fall apart? So for me, it was really important to show that you can have, and that many people do have, very functioning, normal, great, loving relationships, and that by removing homophobia from our world, you know, I made the choice not to ever explore that on the show. You are showing by example just how full a life and how joyous a life and how love-filled a life you can have without that to fight against. So, yeah, it was a very active choice for me. I didn't want there to be any negativity when it came to sexuality.
It simply is, yeah. The playing of games, spin the bottle, twister, a name game, is this trope that kind of runs through the show beginning in the first season. And the playing of these games almost always starts out innocently and then quickly go awry. Why do you come back to game playing throughout the show?
I can't tell. It's interesting you brought that up because I think, if we're being honest, I think it's because I'm an incredibly competitive game player. And with every game that is played, there is always something that comes out of it that I find very, very funny. Someone loses it over the smallest little thing. I find sort of like competitive situations that obviously don't have very high stakes to be quite rich territory for comedy.
Well, I thought it works to sort of get at some aspects of the characters that maybe they're unwilling to reveal otherwise.
Yeah, and any opportunity to reveal sides of a character that you don't have to write is great because exposition is so boring and it's boring to listen to in a show, it's boring to write. So the more you can find ways of revealing character through action and circumstance, the better, I think.
One episode includes an adult game called Sleepy Mommy. Could you explain what Sleepy Mommy is?
Well, my character David ends up planning a baby shower for one of the moms in the town, and he doesn't have any experience with children or young expecting mothers. So his version of a baby shower is very different than what most people would expect. So one of the baby games, because he was very turned off by the prospect of, you know, putting a chocolate bar in a diaper, that was very sort of vulgar to him. What he thought was quite enjoyable was playing a game, Sleepy Mommy, which is people taking Tic Tacs because he couldn't afford real Tranqs.
at the time and throwing them into the mommy's mouth as a means of sedation.
David, why does this game feel vaguely familiar?
You invented it. We played it a lot growing up.
I can't remember playing.
That's because we got very good at it. I remember Alexis got one in from across the room once.
It's a very twisted, now that I say it out loud, a twisted game, but one that is very much in line with our show. And it's basically like pin the tail on the donkey, but it's just throwing pills into mommy's mouth.
Only when you played it as kids in the show, it was actual drugs.
It was real tranks, yeah. Yes.
I'd like to play a scene from an episode from this season that shows how the Elder Roses, Johnny and Moira, are still a bit out of touch with some day-to-day realities, and it's when they agree to babysit for the town's mayor and his wife.
Oh, Moira, he spit up on me. And he spit up in the playpen.
Ooh, that cannot be good, John. Its body is ejecting things. What did you do to it?
Nothing. I changed his diaper, that's all.
Well, perhaps you've swaddled its abdomen too tightly, or maybe it's allergic to something. John, did you feed it shellfish? What did you do?
In that episode, they talk about how they weren't that removed, and I believe my character says, you put us in different wings of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's really where a lot of the emotionality of the show comes from, too, this realization that, you know, perhaps as a family, they didn't do their best to show up for one another. And I think in a way, that's why families have been watching the show together. It's sort of this dream scenario where adult kids move back into the house with their parents and they get a second chance at correcting some of the mistakes that might have been made during, you know, the upbringing stages.
Yeah. So now as we enter into season five and the Rose family is becoming more enmeshed in this new life and really in some ways, you know, starting to embrace it without giving too much away, can you say if you imagine some kind of conclusion in the near future or is the future of the Rose family a little more open-ended?
Well, I mean, I know how the show ends. I've known for quite some time. And I think there's definitely more stories to tell. We have a few more chapters, I think, ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about the inherent premise of the show is that with every passing season and ultimately with every passing episode, we get to peel back the layers slowly but surely on all of these characters and continue to reveal more things about themselves, but also about the interrelationships between them all. And fortunately, we have such a lovely cast that, you know, getting to write for all of these actors is a treat and something I don't want to end anytime soon. But, you know, when it's time to end the show, it will be because that is the right thing to do. I have such a respect for the audience as well. I think the minute someone sits down to watch a show, you're investing a lot of time that you could be, you know, investing anywhere else. And we don't take that lightly. So when we're asking an audience to sit with us for four or five, however many seasons we have, I want to make sure that we never take advantage of that relationship. And when it's time to say goodbye, it will be because that is the most appropriate thing we can do. And we never want to take advantage of that kind of loyalty and sort of overstay our welcome. But I do think we have more story to tell. And I'm very excited about season five. It's my favorite by far.
Daniel Levy is the co-creator, showrunner, and star of the hit pop series Schitt's Creek, now entering its fifth season. Daniel, thanks so much, and congratulations on all the success of the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
New episodes of that series air Wednesday nights on the Pop Cable Network. Coming up, an experimental dance troupe fuses ancient and modern techniques to explore Latino identity and sexuality. The next time you hold a rose in your fingers, take a closer look at the point where the flower meets the stem. At the base, you'll find a small cup of tiny green leaves where the colorful petals shoot out to form the bloom. That's called the hypanthium. It essentially holds and protects all the good stuff inside, like the flower's nectar. Hypanthium is also the title of a new dance performance by choreographer Sebastian Hernandez. The Frame contributor, Marcos Najera, tells us why the artist chose the name.
In the same way our bodies hold and protect the human reproductive system, the hypanthium of a flower helps hold and protect the delicate parts of the plant. In a way, that's what multimedia artist Sebastian Hernandez thinks about a theater.
A place where could be really beautiful things come out of, but it could also be like intense. There could be like drama, but there could be like really good moments.
Hernandez, who identifies as they or she, has an upcoming premiere at Red Cap. Appropriately enough, it's called Hypanthium. After learning that word last year while working on a piece about community gardens, Hernandez felt the word captured the spirit of this new show.
Try to find moments of just like playing with direction. The light and space.
Mm-hmm. Alongside fellow dancers Angel Acuña and Autumn Randolph, Hernandez jumps, glides, and slides across the stage. The trio wrestles with movements that explore big ideas like power, survival, and sexuality. In essence, the same elements Hernandez admits to grappling with as an emerging queer artist in an often unkind world.
Definitely, I understand that as a trans femme, as a transgender nonconforming person on an everyday life, like my life is at stake. I feel like a danger and a presence it's just present. Just like hate and like transphobia, queer, like phobia, like homophobia, whatever it is, like I feel it. What is the danger? Just like walking out the house and like walking out the house literally will feel like, like here I go, like hopefully I have a good day today, or like someone doesn't f*** me today on the bus or whatever.
Backstage at the Red Cap, Hernandez is quick to point out that human rights groups have noted that the lifespan for trans women tops out around 35 years old.
And I'm 28, so I know that I'm close to that kind of, you know, I don't know, just like close to that life expectancy. And like, I'm wondering if I'm going to get there, really.
That's heavy. Are you being serious about that?
Yeah, I'm being very serious about that. It's something that I think I've settled with and made peace with also too, like my death.
And part of making that peace, says Hernandez, has been exploring her path to performance.
So I grew up in Huntington Park.
Hernandez recalls childhood memories with a mixture of pain and pride. There was a strong Latino community, but there was also lots of bullying back then for a little boy who didn't quite fit inside a macho mold.
My body could not escape. It's like femininity. It's natural femininity. And so whether I thought I was like disguising myself or not, like people could smell it on the streets and they would call things out at me, you know? So, and I'd be like confused, because sometimes it's like actual catcall, like they want something from you, or it's like taunting you, right? And like, this is how I get attention from like this feminine figure. It's almost like maybe it's like a homoerotic thing. Oh, I also grew up Mormon. I don't know if you knew that.
It turns out that Hernandez's Mormon upbringing contributed to a strong sense of movement.
We would make parties together, and there was like cumbias and merengue, and like it was just like a lot of people, like Salvadorian people, Guatemalan people, Mexican people. That's where I learned rhythm, through my parents.
But that wasn't the only place Hernandez learned to move her body. Behind a closed bedroom door, she'd turn on music videos and study hard. But can't you
see? I mean, I was looking at Britney Spears and Destiny's Child and Janet Jackson and who else? Like Beyonce. I don't know. I was like copying their moves. So it was like a different thing. It was like femininity that it was like very sacred to me because no one could see it. I would lock myself in the room and like just dance there and fully feel what I needed to feel in that moment. And I wouldn't show that to anyone.
Soon enough, Hernandez found herself up in the Bay Area, studying dance at UC Berkeley. And that's where the Mormon merengue parties, the bedroom Janet Jackson jams, mixed with her formal training. Hernandez quickly discovered how to turn years of emotional pain into powerful performance.
It's like in the last 5 years that I feel like people are like have seen me like actually in performance see this kind of like sacred femininity put on a stage or in a performance or in a gallery. actually doing the things that you would only do in your room, putting them like on display, showing yourself in this very vulnerable way. It's like beautiful.
We don't have to touch right now.
I'm down to do it if y'all want to do it.
And then.
Which brings us back to the rehearsal room of Hypanthium. And a hard-earned awareness, says Edna, on this, that this new show represents a garden well worth tending.
Kind of coming from this feeling of like, I might not get this platform ever again. I might not get this opportunity ever again or to show at this theater. Which kind of harkens back to like the life expectancy thing, like just like running out of time. Like that's always something that is in the back of my head. Hypanthium is something that blooms, something that harvests, maybe like generates goodness. It's like a complex place to live in.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Hypanthium will be performed tonight through Saturday at Red Cat inside Walt Disney Concert Hall. And that's our show for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Join us tomorrow from the Sundance Film Festival with John Horn back in the host chair.